This week's Pseudopod is brought to you by the Detective Inspector Chen Mysteries, written by Liz Williams and published by Nightshade Books. Book 4, The Shadow Pavilion, is out in May. Pseudopod, Episode 90. May 16th, 2008. This week's story, The Exhibition by Melinda Selmes. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from Melinda Selmes. It's previously unpublished, but if you're looking for more of Melinda's work, I'd recommend checking out vulgatamagazine.org. Your narrator this week is Heather Welliver, co-host of Greywolf's Geek Life and frequent guest of the ADD cast, amongst many, many other credits. So grab some hors d'oeuvres and cram on the exhibition note, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Exhibition by Melinda Selmes. They were laid out on a pallet of ice dragged down from the mountains, their drugged forms folded against each other like a cut of fresh, raw meat. The gallery had opened less than an hour ago, but the exhibits had been arranged early enough to allow the flesh to grow white from the frostbite and the lips on their downturned faces to darken to blue. The murky green and gray light filtered through the arching stained glass ceiling, added to the impression of inhumanity, and made the freezing bodies on the table look as though they were already rotten, even though they were not yet dead. Across an aisle, cluttered with murmuring critics, a glassy-eyed form was laid like a half-filleted fish, the skin of his chest stretched back to reveal God's handiwork. His lungs inflated and exhaled to a slow tempo, pumping the icy blood slowly through the carefully exposed veins. Beside him, another had been shaved of all hair, his legs stretched and broken at the hip socket, then tucked in underneath his body. It was impossible to tell whether the thick, slightly rusted iron spit that slid between those disjointed legs and emerged at the base of his neck actually ran through his entire body, or whether it was only an illusion. In either case, it had been carefully done, and though a heavy dose of sedatives kept him from screaming and disturbing the visitors, it was clear that he was still alive. This was the first time in over a century that Garnet had found the courage to attend an exhibition. In those days, the fashion had been deliberate deformity, men made with the faces of beasts or misshapen into the likeness of a turning screw. The art of it had been to make the most severe possible departure from the human form without creating something too monstrous to be viable. Apparently, things had grown worse in 150 years. "Give us a blessing, little mother," the man standing next to Garnet said to her. He clearly fancied himself a critic of the arts, dressed in the new style, layers of expensive cloth and furs draped so that they loudly proclaimed the wealth of one who could afford natural fabrics, while doing nothing to clothe or obscure the body of the wearer. His laugh was as joyless and acerbic as bubbling vinegar. "That one only blesses monsters." His companion, who was neither male nor female, sipped its wine and ran its fingers along the surface of the blood-drenched ice. "But aren't we all monsters, darling? After all, aren't we all monsters?" Garnet did not respond to this exchange. Her legs were weak, and she clung to the jeweled grip of an expensive wooden cane. It was the one extravagance that she still allowed herself. That cane and a thin robe of real organic fabric from beyond the wasteland. Her body was too thin to support a metal shirt, and even when she had been young and her clay damp and supple, her legs had not been thick enough to hold her up unaided. It had been a matter of economy. Clay was required to make a body, and clay was the only currency of any real value. Now, as the centuries passed, and her clay started to dry and crumble, it was becoming difficult to walk, even with these luxuries. The people on display were different. They had been shipped in from a distant battlefield, and their bodies were not made of clay, but of flesh. They weren't capable of withstanding the temperature of their icy bed, and by the time the gallery closed tonight, they would be dead. The exhibit would go on. Fresh ice would be loaded into the rail cars, and fresh prisoners brought from the war, and in the morning, the artist would arrive to rearrange his masterpieces before the gallery opened. When she could no longer bear to stand vigil over the dying, Garnet retreated to one of the old wings of the gallery. In a room filled with the crumbling blocks of an ancient fresco, she collapsed in weariness. The stones were damp, and the water dripped from them like pus from a wound, but nothing, not a spot of moss or mildew, had grown over the painted images. They were scenes from a life lost millennia ago, the icons of a saint who Garnet, for all her centuries, had never known. Little remained of the painting, which had once stood as tall as a cathedral. It had taken 10 years to paint it, the last act of hope committed by a suicide. "You are too weak for this world," Garnet told the painter, "and too much of a coward." She meant, "Why have you left me alone with this inheritance of suffering?" The stones did not answer. She lowered her head and allowed exhaustion with the present to consume her. In the sleepless rest of her kind, she slipped into a memory as vivid as a dream. From the moment that he stepped into the council chamber, defeat had been carved out in the two thin planes of his face. He had once been a tower of wealth and glory. His body, crafted of immortal clay, seized from the foundation of the world, had been a monument to the grandeur of creation. A single scraping from his back might have mortgaged an ordinary man. Now his body had been pillaged. Layers of clay painstakingly scraped away from his back, his legs, his chest, his cheeks hollowed out, his limbs sliced off and reattached so that the valuable connecting material could be excised. The priestly robes that he had once filled like a demigod hung limply from his awkward frame, and he walked like a poltergeist held together by pain. They had been the architects of revolution, but the gaping teeth of the torture chambers did not yawn for them. The accused were lined up across the back of the council chamber, their arms twisted and held in bolted manacles, their faces haggard with the realization that they were being abandoned to suffer the sentence for high treason. Neither Garnet nor the painter could bear to look towards their one-time allies. Both knew, from the way in which they could not meet each other's eyes, that their treachery had been mutual. Garnet wrenched herself back to consciousness before she had to relive the rest. This was the risk of memory, that the traitor's psyche would pull you into something more painful than the present. "We wanted so much to save our own lives," she told the stones bitterly. "We ended up sacrificing a civilization." The stones did not answer. They had died long ago, unable to bear the weight of betrayal. She took the long way back to the exhibit, down a roadway paved in dull gemstones, curving through a forest of lusterless glass and metal trees. The heavy sky leaned menacingly on the world, threatening a rain that it had not delivered for centuries. It was this way wherever her people settled. They brought the wasteland with them, in their hearts and in their bodies, in the turning of their machines in the fertile soil, and the roots of their civilization, which twisted into the ground like an iron screw into a living body. The foil and crystal garden was supposed to give the impression of created beauty, just as the stained glass walls were supposed to filter the eternal drabness into something that resembled color. Even from here, though, she could see the world around her as it really was. The serpentine curlings of the rails as they ran across the damp and inorganic desert, the huge bodies of the monsters running the train cars, men of pitch and gravel, cast in molds instead of sculpted, crudely fashioned to be cheap and useful. A race of disposable slaves, so primitive and inarticulate that it was easy to imagine them devoid of souls. They called Garnet their mother, and she was so in a double sense. She recalled with regret, but no longer with pain, that she had been the first to make such creatures. Hers had been of clay, and not of lesser materials, but still deliberately deformed, robbed of intelligence, given life so they could serve as tools, human conveniences. The second sense was new, a result of the painter's stamp on her life before he had taken his own. He had bequeathed to her his priestly robes, the right to bless, and the obligation to serve even the lowest and most inhuman of their kind. Garnet managed a very thin smile, which crackled the drying corners of her mouth. Several flakes of valuable clay, too dried out to be of further use, flaked off and settled into the breezeless twilight. From the pocket of her robes, she drew out a small, dried-up plum. Once, she had walked through a real orchard, where the fruit that had swung from the branches was full of juice and life. Here, even this was a luxury. She lifted it to her lips and bit off the tiniest of all possible fragments. The flavor was intensely delicious, a feverish wine, and she wanted to devour it with all the decadence that she had once enjoyed before she had traded the power for an ideal, and an ideal for cowardice. "You are not allowed here," a voice thudded. It was a voice of mud and silt. The man who spoke was one of the highest grades of monster. She could see the pebbles and dust molded into his gravelly hands, but there was red there too, real clay. "Why is that?" she asked. "You are not allowed here." A sense of disappointment settled into her clay lungs. She had hoped that there was enough of the currency of life in his body that he was capable of speech, but most likely his throat had been designed to utter only these sounds, his mind imprinted with a single series of words and a command to show him when to use them. Speech, to him, was function, not communication. There were means by which the mangled and the mutilated learned to express themselves to one another, signals of body and of hand. But there were 1,000 dialects, and Garnet would not have known his, even if he had tried to sign to her. Speaking the only universal tongue, she held out the dried plum. The man stared at it dumbly as the minutes stretched, and then finally seized it between rough fingers and shoved it into the devouring gorge of his throat. A flicker of pleasure registered on the surface of his inexpressive form, so slight that only one as well versed as she in the art of reading bodies could have noticed it. She had learned that beneath these tiny signals lay a wealth of gratitude, inaccessible, but deeper than anything discoverable in the most finely crafted features of the rich. This was probably the only food-grade organic material he would ever consume in his life. He swallowed and adjusted his stance. "You are not allowed here," he said. She nodded wearily and turned back towards the main gallery. The exhibit had now been on for nearly 3 hours. Its novelty had started to wear off. Within a week, the bodies freezing to death on the table would be considered a hackneyed joke. Another artist would invent an even more outlandish degradation. The corpses would be ground into a paste with dirt and stone and fed to the monsters. Nothing would be wasted. It was all such a waste. There was nothing now that she could do about it. Her chance to redeem the world had passed by centuries ago. She had given it up for a handful of dust. Nothing remained to her except a little-known office and a faith that had died with the suicide of its founder. Clinging to her oaken cane, she walked towards the exhibition. The leg of one of the bodies had begun to twitch, seized by involuntary spasms. Another had already choked to death on his own tongue. She did not close her eyes, because this was the world that she had chosen, and she had to see it for what it was. She extended one hand. Her skin was old and crackled, her voice as dry as burning paper. There was only one power that remained to her. In honor of their humanity, and in memorial of her own, she bowed toward the frozen men and intoned the benediction for the dying.
The best art leaves something behind of the artist. That can be literal too. One of my favourite pieces, which was exhibited at the Tate Modern for a while, was in effect a really big ant farm. Coloured sand had been poured into rectangular blocks in the shape of world flags, and over time the ants would track it from one section to another. The ants have long since died, but the art they helped build is still very much alive. Then, slightly closer to home, there's the story of Mark Grunewald. Mr. Grunewald was a legendary comic writer and inker who, on his death in 1996, was cremated and his ashes mixed with the first trade paperback collection of his Squadron Supreme series. There, the art and the artist are one, and it's difficult to draw a distinction between the two at the best of times. Frida Kahlo, Da Vinci, Picasso, and dozens more have all become icons in their own right. But was that the goal? Should art be about the artist or about the response of the person looking at it or listening to it? Art, when it comes down to it, grants the artist a second life, whether they want it or not. From the Sistine Chapel to Chris Ofili's elephant dung artwork, from Squadron Supreme to the Just This Once, Everyone Lives speech in one of Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who episodes, art elicits an emotional response, and if the artist is very lucky, that response hooks it in the viewer's memory. That's why I can still hum the theme to Otherworld, which dates me horribly, by the way, why the closing scene of Clerks 2, with Frustrated Incorporated by Soul Asylum playing as the screen fades to black and white, chokes me up every single time. It's why I still reread certain old Batman comics, why Isaac Asimov stories still make me smile. It's also why I'm very glad the piece of X-Files fanfic I wrote when I was 19 is nowhere on the internet, but I'm not going there. Pseudopod is powered by many things. Steve's awesome field, Ben's pitbull-like dedication, and my banal optimism all play their parts. So does the Shoggoth on the treadmill, but we don't really like to talk about him. What really powers us, though, is you. Our writers are also our readers. So if you want to have a crack at being on the pod, then go to pseudopod.org and check our guidelines. Give it a shot. We promise every submission is read and responded to. You also power us through feedback. Like the story? Tell us. Hate the story? Tell us. And tell us why. There are comment threads on every post and a forum linked from the website. Go. Discuss. Mingle. Have a volivon. They're on us. Most importantly, though, we rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. Every red cent is appreciated. What really fascinates me about Detective Inspector Chen is continuity, and not in the traditional sense. There's linking tissue between the books, certainly, but one of the things that really comes out in Shadow Pavilion is continuity of identity. The rigidly structured Heaven and Hell Liz Williams depicts both have their charms and their strengths, but they are both, fundamentally, run by flawed individuals, by people or demons who make mistakes and try and deal with that. It's an oddly comforting view of the next life, that the same mistakes can be made there. It's a very grounded view, in fact, of what is, in essence, a very ethereal subject, and one of the things that really marks the series out as something special. And besides, how can you not love this? He's the liaison between Earth, Heaven and Hell. His partner's a demon vice cop with nice issues. They fight crime. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod knows you should never touch the body.